Your Bible's open to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Notice there is one other little detail I want to grab here before we move on to the next issue. Again, we are looking at what I consider is just as an important issue as the details of this additional covenant, which is commonly referred to as the Palestinian covenant, but I kind of refer to it as the covenant of God's Jehovahness and grace. I understand why it's called Palestinian. Maybe I'm too harsh on that, but it's just tough to, in some quarters today, if you talked about a Palestinian covenant, especially with the way things are today, they might really misunderstand what's going on. So, but this additional covenant is, there's as much preparatory work that God has Moses do with the children of Israel as they sit there ready to go in, thinking they're something that they're not. I mean, these people aren't even circumcised. They've gone through 40 years and lost one of the major identifying marks of what they are to be separate from other nations. And that's why when they go across the river and they have their first battle at Jericho, in which they are very successful under that great military commander and believer, Joshua. People talk about speeches and great speeches. You'll never see a greater State of the Union address than the final chapter of Joshua in your life. It's just the most amazing chapter. But when he takes them over there, the first thing he does with them, he has them recircumcised. And this, again, I wasn't trying to paint a rosy picture of how Israel existed during that Balaam-Balak incident, because they had actually corrupted themselves with the prostitutes of Moab and were a mess before they ever got into the land. So in light of that, look at these final few verses here in chapter 28. To have all of this ringing in these young people's ears before they go in to actually begin. And again, this isn't just simply the conquest of a land. You understand that. Satan understands exactly what's going on here. This is one of the reasons why Satan produced from up here, there's a little town up here along the Euphrates River called Pethor, and brought that super duper prophet Balaam down, who was not only a super duper prophet, but he was also a super duper politician who could bring nations confederate together. And that's what he was trying, the king of Moab was trying to do, is make a confederacy of nations. And that's a preview of what's going to happen in the tribulation. There's going to be a confederacy of nations come against Israel, a 10-nation confederacy. They're not European. There's not a single European nation in the 10-nation confederacy. And yet almost any book of prophecy you get, that you pick up, is going to talk about the common market of Europe being the 10 nations. That's extra-biblical. The Bible lists what the nations are for you. They're in God's Word. They're just overlooked. Nobody sees them. But they're all there. I've got a chart on it. That's the preview of what that whole episode was about. And it was being done with these people in this condition. But before they go in now thinking they're something, he wants them to know what they really are at heart and what God has tried to do with them. Look at the final words that they get to hear here. Look, let your eyes scan down. Pick it up at verse 63. And this again is, they're just getting ready to go in the land. And it shall come to pass that as the Lord rejoiced over you, we read this last time, to do good and to multiply you, and so the Lord will rejoice over to destroy you and bring you to naught. And you shall be plucked off from the land whither thou goest to possess it. But what I wanted to do, I don't think I caught the last one. In verse 64, and the Lord shall scatter thee. There they go out under the fifth course of punishment. Among all the people from one end of the earth even unto the other. And there thou shalt serve other gods, small case g, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations thou shalt find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But the Lord shall give thee there an trembling heart, and failing eyes, and sorrow of mind. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have none assurance of thy life. In the morning when thou shalt say, would God that it were evening, and at even thou shalt say, would God that it were morning, for the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see, and the Lord shall bring thee into Egypt again. That's where some of them went in the captivity, with ships, and by the way thereof, whereof I spake unto thee, thou shalt see it. No, by the way, one of the things I wanted to do to get to verse 68, we're not going to have time to go back and look at all of this. But when they came up here, the first time that they came up here in up to Kadesh Barnea, and they looked there, and then they complain. What is one of the things that they constantly said? I think this is really interesting. Why did you take us out of Egypt? Would to God that we were back in Egypt. As bad as it was there, it's not like this. I don't understand this thinking. You just see the Red Sea parted. You see God stave off the greatest military might on the face of this earth, the Egyptian cavalry and their whole army, and he staves them off for you while you get across. Then he lets them come across and then baptizes them. I kid when I say that. He kills them all off, including Pharaoh himself, Yul Brynner. Hollywood couldn't do it. Cecil B. DeMille could not bring himself to kill off Yul Brynner, but God did. They all died there. And yet, you're complaining that God can't take care, and probably picking manna seeds out of your teeth while you're complaining about it. And they come up there, and what God does, this is beautiful. He actually allows them to what comes out of their mouth to pronounce their own destruction. Would to God you were in Egypt? That's where you're going to go. You just gave your own sentence through your own lips. And that's what the Lord shall bring thee unto Egypt again with ships by the way whereof I spake unto thee. Thou shalt see it no more again. Ye shall be sold to your enemies for bondmen and for bondwomen, and no man shall buy you. You're not even worth being a slave in the eyes of those people. And it's with that emphasis once again of the certainty of the fact of what their future holds. And it's going to be one of this continuing rebelliousness and bringing these curses upon them rather than the blessings. And that's the immediate backdrop for the covenant of God's Jehovahness and grace to save them out of all that they got themselves into. They got themselves into that predicament. God didn't put them there. They got themselves there. And in the backdrop of that, God comes along and says, here's what I'm going to do. Now, that's the second of three things to bear in mind. The first thing, as we looked at before, we'll go back here. I think it was this one. If we take some off of this chart, I've removed a lot of things. The first thing to keep in mind is what took place between the time they came out of the other side of the Red Sea, they crossed the Red Sea, up until Kadesh Barnea when they sent the spies in. That's what I call the background that you need to have. The backdrop is what takes place right here, just before they cross the Jordan River. That's Deuteronomy 28. That's what that new nation is now hearing and what's resonating in their ears. And just as soon as they hear all of that, God comes along in chapter 29, and where they are is right there. X marks the spot, and God says, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make an additional covenant with you. And the third thing that we need to bear in mind that makes this covenant really pop and make it so important to us is to understand, like I said, those last two of the five things we've been looking at in this Exodus stage is this additional covenant and Moses' last acts, which includes the song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32. That song of Moses is so critical and so important because that's what the remnant of Israel is going to sing out there in the tribulation period. They're going to pick up the song of Moses, they're going to sing it with real intelligence. They're going to sing a new song out there. And I always like to hear preachers preach on that passage in the Revelation where they talk about the new song. Wonder what it's going to be. I wonder what it's going to sound like. It's in the Bible. They're going to sing the new song they're going to sing is recorded. It's the new song psalms. That's what the new song psalms are for. They're for the remnant to pick them up and sing them out there. But they're going to sing the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy as well. I'd love to hear the music to that thing. By the way, that's got to be the longest song ever written. But that's the third thing that helps you make this pop. I know we're doing something I normally never do, is run ahead. But these two things go together. This additional covenant God makes of His Jehovahness and grace, and the last acts of Moses come over. As the book of Deuteronomy closes, God Himself comes along, and He does something interesting with Moses. He pulls Moses aside, and He basically says to him, "Look," He talks to him, just the two of them, privately. He says, "Look, I know these people." Remember, God wanted to kill them all twice and just start with Moses. So He basically tells Moses, I've seen these people's rebelliousness throughout their history. They're a stiff-necked people. And when they cross over that river and they enter into the land, I want you to know they're going to proceed on in their rebellion and in their contrariness against me even worse than they've already done. It's not going to be the same or less. It's going to be worse once they get into the land than anything they've done prior to it. So God takes Moses aside, and He really deals with him privately and tells him just before Moses dies there on Mount Nebo that what He's just described to Israel is the very thing that's going to take place. Come over to chapter 31 with me for a moment before we look at the details of this additional covenant. And look at verse 14. This is what this whole covenant is couched in, before and behind. This the rebelliousness of these people, and that they're going to be even worse when they go in. Look at verse 14. It says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Behold, thy days approach that thou must die." By the way, stop right there for a moment. Do you notice that God doesn't say, "Until the days that thou must pass away, until the days that the angels take thee up to be with me," or some other euphemism or anything like that? He says, "You're going to die. That's what's going to happen. You're going to die. That's what a human body does. The body of corruption dies." I told a Christian lady this once, and she was shocked when I said it. I said, "Why shouldn't it die? Sin has a claim on it. It has a right to it. I don't need it. I can't use it for where I'm going. Flesh and blood can't inherit the kingdom I'm going to." By the way, flesh and blood can inherit the kingdom on this earth, the kingdom of heaven on earth. There's going to be some Jews that are alive in their physical bodies that go in and take it. But mine has to have something different because I'm going to be in the creature out in the heavenly places. Sin has a right to this body. So it's going to get old. It's going to fall apart and it's going to die. But there's no sugarcoating it. It dies. That's what sin does. It kills. I don't want to make a sermon out of it. That's your devotion of the day. There's your daily bread. Old M.R. DeHaan would be proud of me. Some of you don't are so heathen you don't even know who that is. That's all right. "In the days approach that thou must die." And this is because Moses, of course, instead of speaking to the rock, he struck the rock twice. And screwed up God's whole analogy there, what he was trying to do and the doctrine he was trying to teach. And Moses pays the price. He goes up on Mount Nebo. He can look into the land. And I think God adjusts his eyes. Either that or Mount Nebo was a whole lot taller then than it is now. Because I don't think I could see from Mount Nebo everything that God gave Moses to see. But he got kind of a multimedia visual tour of the entire land just before he dies. But anyway, he says, "Call Joshua," there's his predecessor, his second in command, he's going to be promoted, "and present yourselves in the tabernacle of the congregation that I may give him a charge." And Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves in the tabernacle of the congregation. And the Lord appeared in the tabernacle in a pillar of cloud, and the pillar of the cloud stood over the door of the tabernacle. And the Lord said unto Moses, "Behold, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, and this people will rise up and go and worship me in praise and song." No. "And go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake me, and break my covenant which I have made with them. By the way, this would be really sad to Moses had it not been for chapter 29 and 30. Moses knew, outside of this section of our timeline chart, Moses pretty much knew how this chart was going to run. Moses had nobody knew about the dispensation of grace. Not even Jesus Christ in his earthly ministry ever mentioned it or ever alluded to this dispensation of grace taking place. Never, not one time. This was something totally new and only revealed to and through the Apostle Paul. So Moses didn't know about this, but he could have pretty much tracked right along with everything we're doing right here. So he knew how it was going to end, that this Jehovah-ness and grace covenant was going to lead to God saving these people. Now, ladies and gentlemen, why is this important for us in Romans? Without even turning there, do you realize what Paul says there in Romans 9, 10, and 11 when he goes over all of this? He talks about Israel and he says, all Israel shall be saved. He's not talking about individual Israelites or Jews. He's talking about that nation is going to be saved. All of it is going to be saved. And when Paul says what he says in Romans 9, 10, and 11, if you don't have at least a working understanding of what we're talking about here, it's just going to be words on a page. And that's critical, because when Paul gets later on in his epistles, when he goes into the book of Ephesians, and he starts talking about time past, but now, to come, starts talking about this dispensation of grace, he starts talking about some things he lays the groundwork for here in Romans 9, 10, and 11 of how your Heavenly Father always deals in matters legally. And there is a genius behind what God did when He interrupted the program. He didn't do this arbitrarily. He did this with some real genius in mind and planning and forethought and all the things that He did to bring in this new dispensation of grace in which we live. And you're getting skills to be able to handle that by going through this right now. So it's a fantastic field training exercise, which I've never been through, but throw it out there. Anyway, look at what he says here. He says, and the Lord said unto Moses, you're going to sleep with your fathers. This people go whoring after break my covenant. Pick it up at verse 17. Then mine anger shall be kindled against them in that day. What day is he talking about? He's talking about that day, the Lord's day of wrath. By the way, that's one of the reasons why I have the final installment up there is the Lord's day of wrath and not the tribulation. Because the Lord's day of wrath, the final installment to Israel's program, is more than the tribulation. A little bit, not much, but a little bit. The tribulation is part of it. There's a lag time at the beginning and a lag time at the end. But anyway, we'll get to that later on. But he says, then mine anger shall be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured. They're going out under the fifth course of punishments, culminate in the final installment. They shall be devoured. Many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day for all the evils which they have wrought, in that they are turned unto other gods. That's all part of what they were told about the five courses of punishment. When you start walking contrary unto me, what does that mean? What? Exactly. We think of contrariness as a child in Walmart who won't behave. So we ascribe to contrariness wrongdoing, evil, sin. I've seen children that are sinfully evil in Walmart. Disobedient. But that can't be what that means. The reason is because the next thing, in the next course of punishment, God describes contrariness to Himself. And He says, I will walk contrary unto you. God isn't sinful. He isn't disobedient. He isn't any of those things. Contrariness has another meaning. And in that particular context, it means just what Katie said. Israel's going to treat God as if He wasn't their God. So in the fourth course of punishment, God's going to begin to treat them as if they're not His people. That's why in the new covenant, He talks about, and I will be your God and you will be my people. He's going to restore that whole thing again. Anyway, I bring this up, though, knowing that I'm running ahead of the additional covenant here, but really these final two issues, as I said, Moses' last acts, along with this additional covenant, go together. And you need to realize that in kind of looking ahead, you can see that it's because of God looking ahead, his foreknowledge of Israel's history that forms the basis of him making this additional covenant. He sees what's going to happen to them. That's one of the reasons he has to make this covenant. One more thing to look at real quickly here. Notice in verse 24 again, we're looking at what they're going to be once they cross the Jordan and once they go into the land. Look at verse 24 of chapter 31. It came to pass when Moses made an end of writing the words of this law, the law in a book, until they were finished, that Moses commanded the Levites, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, saying, "Take this book of the law and put it in the side of the ark of the covenant, your God, that it may be there for a witness against thee. For I know thy rebellion, thy stiff neck. Behold, while I am yet alive with you this day, ye have been rebellious against the Lord." while he's alive. "And how much more after my death? Gather unto me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their ears and call heaven and earth to record against them. For I know that after my death, you will utterly, utterly corrupt yourselves." Utterly is not in there twice. I put it in twice. "You will utterly corrupt yourselves and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you, and the evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord and provoke him to anger through the works of your hands." There's what the works of your hands is going to do. And Moses spake in the ears of all the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. This all happened, by the way, in one day. This was a really long Bible class. But what I'm after in reading the final words there, verse 31, really, in order for you to be properly and suitably impressed with this additional covenant of God using his own Jehovah-ness and his own grace to do for them what they could not do for themselves, you've got to couch that covenant in those three issues at least. Those three things give you the capacity to get a grip on what the Jehovah-ness and grace covenant is really all about, and the need for God to come along and say that before you guys ever enter into that land, regardless of what you've done, I'm going to deal with you just like I wanted to deal with you all the way from the very beginning when I began to deal with you out there in Exodus 15 through 18 before you ever came to Mount Sinai. That's how I wanted to deal with you. I wanted to provide your water, your food. I wanted to do battle with your enemies. I wanted to make you so that you would be impressive to the Gentiles and bring the Gentiles into salvation through you. I wanted to do all those things, but you wouldn't have any of it. And that really impresses you with how dark their situation is and God doing for them what they couldn't do for themselves. And if you pay attention, you'll find, as you go on in God's Word, you'll find that when God's dealing with Israel, after she's already gone through the first four courses of punishments and qualified to go into the fifth, when you get out into a book like Isaiah, God comes along and actually hearkens them back to this very covenant, that additional covenant. Just before they go into the fifth, they get a reminder of what God is going to do. You're not going to be destroyed. And I know it looks today, everything to you and me looks today like Israel's going to be destroyed. I mean, that land's a mess. It's basically the size of New Jersey today, and it's been cut up piecemeal by the Palestinians. Every nation on earth seems to be against it. Israel isn't perfect. They certainly aren't making perfect decisions today. But I'll tell you what, you don't want to take them on, because they'll fight you like no other nation on this earth will fight. There's no other piece of property on the face of this earth that has been so fought over than that piece of property. And even if they were taken over, it still doesn't matter. By the way, May of 1948, when Israel became a nation, means nothing biblically. Zero. It's a pointless, stupid thing to perceive. If that's what you're trying to gauge anything biblically by, it means nothing. Israel doesn't have to exist in the eyes of anybody except God. And I don't wish this, but even if Israel today were not even a nation, if they were totally taken over by the Palestinians, is all this still true? Absolutely. Their future glory is absolutely certain, and it has nothing to do with them. It has to do with who their God is and who your Father is. So therefore, that brings us to the next pretty good point here that I wanted to do before we look at the details. Flip back once again to that chapter. I know I denote this before at the end of our last lesson. You see there in verse 28, or chapter 28, verse 58, I mentioned this last session, when he brings up the issue of the glorious, that thou may fear the glorious and fearful name, the Lord thy God. When he does that, God makes a deep impression in chapter 28 upon them with his name once again, concerning his glorious and fearful name in connection with all the courses of curses coming upon them. But that deep impression is designed to get them to be suitably impressed once again with the concept of God's Jehovah-ness, the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, Jehovah name that they were taught about. That's what they were taught about back here. You get those compound names, Jehovah Jireh, Jehovah Nissi, I will be your conquering hero, Jehovah Zidkenu, I will be your righteousness. All those compound names of what his name means to them, and really goes back to the Jehovah name. I am that I am. I am blank. I will be, you fill in the blank, whatever you need for me to be. So that they become, once again, this generation suitably impressed with that name, and they are to, as they go over, and you go over the details of the contract that, of this additional covenant, especially in chapter 30, I want you to just be impressed with how many times the Lord has Moses use that expression over and over and over again. Just flip there. We won't even look at verses so much as just look at... Just let your eye kind of scan down through the chapter and see how it catches things. But you're going to see this expression over and over, the Lord thy God will, the Lord thy God will, the Lord thy God will. The details are set forth here in these first 10 verses. And look at the end of verse, you're in chapter 30. Look at... He's going to scatter them in verse 3. The Lord thy God has scattered thee. But then in verse 5, the Lord thy God will bring these things. Verse 6, the Lord thy God will circumcise. Verse 7, the Lord thy God will put all these curses upon thee. And verse 9, the Lord thy God will do this. Verse 10, the voice of the Lord thy God. See what? I think he's driving at something. I am the Lord thy God. Jehovah thy God will. I will. You've proven you will do nothing but make this worse. And that's an important issue. Maybe not so deep, but it is profound, because by what he's doing, and again, it's the way God oftentimes, it's not only what God says, it's the way he says it. And you start to get, to really be able to appreciate your Bible, you start to perceive the way information's presented. That's very important. And the way that information is presented and the way he does it is to stress the fact that in God's foreknowledge regarding their own rebelliousness, their own impotence and inability and weakness and incapacity, he sets that now in contrast with his own Jehovah-ness, his own ability, his unlimited capacity. That's why when he started out with Moses back here in Exodus chapter 3, at the burning bush, he said, well, I don't know what name to call you. I am that I am. And then the shortened version, I am blank. You have both the issue of God's timelessness and his unlimited capacity, that he will be the blank. He will fill in the blank. You need a redeemer, I'll be your redeemer. You need a general, I'll be your general. You need a supplier, I'll be your supplier. They had a blank check. And God is once again contrasting that against their own, and it's almost like a showdown is taking place. And that they've gotten themselves into such a bad predicament they couldn't get out of, and at particular points as God deals with them, he's going to respond this way. We have one right on the board. This very issue right here. When Israel crosses over the Jordan River, things go pretty well for a while under Joshua, because he's such a great leader. He is probably second to Moses. Moses is, hands down, the greatest leader who ever lived. Nobody can compare. Nobody even close to Moses. I mean, if you took a city the size of New York City and you had to lead them, and not just the people, But I mean open the prisons and the jails and take the criminally insane as well. Moses could lead them. That was the kind of leader he was. He was a genius in many ways. Militarily, musically, that's another thing I like about him. He's a man laughing. Moses is a musician. But Joshua was just about as good. And when you get to the end of the book of Joshua, the book of Judges opens up and you read. We okay back there? You're reading along. That's yours, by the way. I think you scooched down about 5 inches there. As you read along in the book, as the book of Judges opens up, all of a sudden Israel comes up against some iron chariots that they couldn't defeat. That shouldn't happen. That's one of the telltale signs that they're going under the first course of punishment. And that, what is the one word I always tell you is the most beautiful word in that chapter? No, it's close to it. That's it. Say it again, loud. Nevertheless. Nevertheless, God raised up judges. He didn't have to do that. And you see, on occasion after occasion, Israel goes down, God raises up a judge. Israel goes down, God raises up a judge. That's him operating on that additional covenant. He's already begun operating on it in the book of Judges. He didn't have to do that. Did he have to raise up David? Did he have to, when we look at the timeline chart, we understand and appreciate the fact that in between, God actually staves off the second course of punishment with an interlude. Did he have to do that? He didn't have to do that. And he raises up two great kings there, David and his son Solomon. And he actually allows Israel a taste of what the blessings are in Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14. He didn't have to do that. And it's a preview of what that kingdom is going to be like when Christ, David's greater son, sits on the throne of that kingdom. Every time as you're handling your Bible and you're reading it through there and you find, well, they don't deserve that. Of course, that's the importance of this additional covenant. That's God operating upon it. And so you have him doing these things, and at particular points, he's going to respond this way. And Jehovah your God, he says, is going to do this for you, and he'll do this for you, and he'll do that for you. So therefore, this covenant of God providing all things for Israel on the basis of him and his Jehovahness and grace is made with the nation Israel. Now, this is one thing, and we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but let's come back now to chapter 29. I'm going to keep that timeline chart up there. Now, I just said something that I don't know if it's registered with you or not, but this covenant is made with the nation Israel. The nation. I'm not talking about it being made with individual Jews or individual Israelites. It's made with the nation. There's a ton of issues that we haven't even broached, but one of these that we haven't covered that we may wind up getting snags on in our thinking as we start going through some of these other things is being able to distinguish and discern between how God is operating with Israel on a national level and how he's operating with them on an individual level. This new covenant or Palestinian covenant is, in fact, in that respect, I can almost understand the word Palestinian, because at least it makes you think of a national covenant. And that's really what it is. Well, we'll see how things go here. But in view of this covenant being made with the background of their rebellious history, from the time God brought them out of Egypt through the wilderness of Shur to Mount Sinai up to the initial going into the land at Kadesh Barnea, that's the first thing we looked at. In view of the second thing, the recent rebellious corruption of the new generation as they sit there in army bivouac just before they're in Moab going into the land the second time. And the third thing I just mentioned, the Jehovah's covenant made with the nation of Israel in view of the fact that they're going to proceed on even worse than they did before once they've entered into the land. They're going to utterly corrupt themselves. They don't just merely corrupt themselves. If you're going to utterly corrupt yourself, then what's going to happen as far as the curses go? They're all going to hit. You're going to get them all. You're going to get the zenith of the whole thing, the fifth course coming upon you. Well, All of this is extremely important and significant to understand and appreciate, to really, as I say, properly and suitably be impressed with what this additional covenant is all about. And in looking at the details of it, we've seen verse 1 before where this is made besides the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. But as we go on down, let's just read a few of these verses, beginning in verse 2 here. So this is chapter 29, and we'll start looking at a few of these details. As I said, I think I'm going to wind up spending more time on the background than actually the details of it. Verse 2, it says, "And Moses called unto all Israel and said unto them, Ye have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, unto Pharaoh and to all his servants, and unto all his land. The great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs, and those great miracles. Yet the Lord hath not given you an heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day. And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxen old upon you. Thy shoe is not waxen old upon thy foot. Ye have not eaten bread, neither have you drinking wine nor strong drink, that ye might know that I am," there's the Jehovah issue, "the capital O, capital O, capital R, capital D, the Lord your God. And when ye came unto this place," now this is their recent situation, "Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us unto battle, and we smote them." They've had success, preview of what they were going to have in the conquest under Joshua. "And we took their land and gave it for an inheritance to the Reubenites and to the Gadites and the half tribe of Manasseh. Keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that ye may prosper in all that ye do." Now let's stop right there for a moment. Really, verses 2 on through verse 29 is actually preliminary. Everything that he does through the remainder of the chapter is what we just did. Moses goes over and rehearses their background. He goes over their immediate backdrop. He does all of those things that we have just done. But what I'm after, thinking about how best to say this, the actual details of the contract are in the first 10 verses of chapter 30. And as I say, what God's done is and will do here amounts to what we've done before. But I just read those first from verse 2 through verse 9. And you remember the curses that I talked about, and how they're all gonna come upon the nation of Israel. And God tells them there, do you remember all that? And then he tells them that's exactly what God contracts to do in the face of it all. But beginning in verse 10, Moses exhorts them, and he does this nationally. Now, I probably shouldn't do this, because right now I don't feel like there's a problem. And I normally don't do this, because I wind up where there's not a problem, causing a problem. But do you see any... When I read through verse 2 through verse 9 there, was there any one verse that stood out to you and said, I don't get that? Please don't say all of them. But is there one peculiar thing that's said there? You've got a 1 in 8 chance. Verse 4. That's what I thought. Yeah, verse 4. And I was wondering if anybody would read that and say, why does God say in verse 4, yet the Lord hath not given you an heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day? Okay. That's for another class. Good night. No. This is one of the reasons why I was stressing to you that what God is doing here, he's doing on a national level. When he uses that verse in verse 4, he's not talking about an individual Israelite. He's talking about them nationally. Hold your place here. We're going to turn right back. I want you to come over to something our apostle says, the apostle Paul. Come over to Ephesians chapter 2. Put your ribbon there or finger there if it won't go to sleep. And come over to Ephesians chapter 2. When Paul comes along and reminds us what we were in time past, And that means this time past here. You and I are Gentiles. And what we were under God's time past program, you see up here on the chart where it says Gentiles, uncircumcised, far off, and without God. When he's explaining, by the way, when did we get in that position? Anybody? Tower of Babel. And that's what Paul describes in Romans chapter 1 when he says God gave them over. The entire human race was given up, given over by the time you got to the Tower of Babel. And then God has to choose one man and he's going to begin with him the repossession of this earth, and that was Abraham. All right. When Paul is describing to us, for reasons that are not just to make us aware of this, pick it up at verse 11. Wherefore remember that ye being in time past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by that which is called the circumcision in the flesh made by hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. And then you get those beautiful words, but now in Christ Jesus, you were sometimes far off or made nigh, so forth and so on. What I'm after is there in verse 12, a rare expression that only occurs here when talking about Israel, the commonwealth of Israel. That's what God is talking about back there in Deuteronomy. When he's talking about, come back to the Deuteronomy passage. When he's talking about there in verse 4, and he says, yet the Lord hath not given you, he's not talking about you individually. He's talking about the commonwealth of Israel. We still have a few states in the United States that are commonwealths. Virginia is one of them, the greatest state in the Union, in my opinion. I know some think that Texas is the greatest state. I've never met a Texan that didn't think Texas was the greatest state. Well, I got news for Texans. Their greatest hero, Sam Houston, a Virginian. Check it out. Sam Houston was a Virginian. Anyway, what was I saying? The Commonwealth. There was that expression, when God uses it, there was a commonwealth that had to do with how he developed the nation of Israel. You'll notice something I said earlier. When he starts talking to them, come down, look at verse 10. He says, ye stand this day, all of you, there's the whole nation, before the Lord your God, your captains, your tribes, your elders, and your officers, with all the men of Israel. Look at the next verse, though. Your little ones, your wives, thy stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood to the drawer of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into the covenant of the Lord thy God, into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day. Now what I'm after is that there's more in view here than just Israel. The land of Israel is looked at as a commonwealth, and that includes even a Gentile stranger that is in your house. And God created and actually developed this commonwealth of Israel to where an unbelieving Gentile who was on the land of Israel and under the commonwealth of Israel would be prosperous because of that blessing that they were receiving in association with Israel. And it's not saved or justified or unjustified in view. It's what God is going to do with the entire... And that's what's going to happen out there when the kingdom is established and set up. And what I'm after in that is that when what he says there in verse 4 has in view the national entity where even Gentiles in that nation are in view, even the unbeliever, unjustified person is in view, and it's got a lot to do with this issue of what Paul calls later on this commonwealth of Israel. And God is actually determined to deal with the national entity of Israel in a particular way. And one of the particular ways that he's done this, he says, what I've doing and what I've done, and he's done it, is to cause it so all the way back here, the crossing of the Jordan is on the timeline, we're about right where we are, X just before the crossing. Well, yeah, I want the whole thing up here, so we'll just put an X here. They're right there. All right. How quickly to answer this? When Israel was down in Egypt, you get to the end of the book of Genesis, right? Genesis chapter 50. Joseph was taken slave down into Egypt, and you wind up with about 70 Jews down in Egypt in slavery by the time the book of Genesis ends. That's a small group, but that's going to incubate in slavery and form an entire nation, right? Okay. When they come out of Egypt, and God begins dealing with them through the 10 plagues, which were all designed to be their first phase of education into His Jehovahness. He takes them through like the first three, and they all fall on everybody. But beginning with the next plague through the 10th one, Israel's exempt. Israel didn't get the darkness. That's why they were in that little area called the land of Goshen. To this day, people, when they want to say something very positive, they say, "Land of Goshen!" Or at least they did in Indiana. My aunt did. Aunt Fern. Land of Goshen! Anyway. It was designed to teach the nation of Israel that while everybody else was getting these plagues and they weren't, they should have got them too. They deserved everything those Egyptians were getting. Every single thing. They were just as undeserving and just as rotten as the Egyptians, and they should have got it all too. They flunked that, so God takes them through five additional courses. They flunked that. Now, remember me talking about this root of this rotten attitude that they didn't deserve that? Now, you tell me, what does that root develop into? In Israel. What? Exactly. That root is going to incubate and develop. And it's going to develop into what will become in the gospel accounts when Christ is here on this earth. It will be that vain religious system. That's why Jesus, when He was on this earth, said, "Unless your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees." The Pharisees had developed an entire... The Pharisees, by the way, are biblical scholars. And they had developed because they had breakthroughs. I've had pastors, I've been at a pastor's conference, they said, "Mark, how many breakthroughs have you had?" "None. And I don't expect to have any. The book, as I last checked, is over 2,000 years old." But these Pharisees had some real breakthroughs, breakthrough doctrines. And they were all corrupted doctrines. And they had corrupted the system of the law so that when Jesus came, He had to do what the prophet said He would do. The Messiah would come and liberate the law. He would free it from its corruption and the corrupted doctrine. That's why James talks about the law as the perfect law of liberty. The perfect law of liberty is the law of Moses liberated from its corruption. You would know that if you were paying attention to what God was doing in the gospel accounts. But anyway, as Jesus would come along and do that, He had to, and He squared off against that vain religious system. All right, what is God going to do with that vain religious system? What's He going to do in His day of wrath? What? He's going to purge it. He's going to destroy that whole vain religious system. It's one of the reasons why the book of 1 John is a book of litmus tests for the remnant of Israel. If you want to get me to go from 0 to 100, 0 being nice, to 100 being mad as a wet hen or a wet cat, try and tell me that 1 John is the way that we determine whether or not a person is saved. I hear it all the time. "Well, you can't be a Christian and sin like that. 1 John tells you that you can't be a Christian and sin like that." And they take their little Greek out and they say, "Well, no, that doesn't say that. It says if you habitually sin, then you're not a Christian." That's not what it says either. It says what it says. And it's a litmus test, not to determine if you and I are Christians or not. First John is a litmus test for the remnant to be able to find out who is a wheat and who's a tare, who's a sheep and who's a wolf, because those people who look like, walk like, talk like, and act like the true remnant of Israel are going to be part of the apostate element, and they're going to try to kill those men. It's a life and death issue there. That's why they have to operate that way. What I'm after in bringing all this back into your thinking is that all the way back in the book of Deuteronomy, God intentionally does something to the nation who has a history before you ever get to X marks the spot of developing this vain religious system, and he's going to destroy that thing. And he's going to intentionally give them, as it says in verse 4 there, let me get back to it, to quote it. Yet the Lord hath not given you an heart to perceive and eyes to see and ears to hear unto this day. What do you think? That makes a whole lot of sense now out of what Jesus would say when he was speaking on this earth. He would speak the truth to these Pharisees, Sadducees, lawyers, chief priests, and scribes. And he'd say, you don't have ears to hear. You don't have eyes to see. They said, I love there, is it in John where they talk about, show us a miracle. And he says, I've shown you the miracles. And you won't believe. And do you know what he does? At one point in Matthew's account, he takes him right back to Moses and he said, you didn't believe Moses. How would you believe me? What I'm doing is trying to make you see the connections that are going on. What God was developing back there is something that he has seen to it that nation, while they're under these courses of punishment, they're never going to see or hear or perceive. And they're going to one day be, he almost makes it so that he counts them, and that's not the word I want. He almost reckons them as fit for destruction. And that's totally in keeping with what that rebellious, stiff-necked, apostate nation is going to have all through their history. That's why when Jesus was on this earth and when he first began preaching in the synagogues, they gave him the scroll, the book, and it was closed. And they gave it to him closed. And he opened it up and he read it and he brought forth the words, but it was so great and such a wonderful detail that when he gave it back to the rabbi, he closed it and gave it back to him, because the very prophets that he was reading said, this is a closed book and no man can open it to you until the Messiah. That proved him in one way to be the Christ. So do you see what I'm after there? What God is actually doing is a forecast of how that nation is not going to see nor hear nationally. It has nothing to do with them individually. That individual Jew can be justified as quickly as the guy did in Jesus' day that we read about, who smote himself on the breast and said, have mercy upon me, a sinner. And Jesus said, that man went away justified. By the way, he was justified without hearing about the cross. But he operated upon the gospel as it was given to him at that time and responded exactly as God wanted him to respond, and he went away justified. So what you've got here is a statement that seems peculiar and out of place, and yet when you understand what's happening nationally and you understand some things about that, how God is almost, I hate to use, I'm not going to use that word, reckoned as it were, or seen to it that he's going to personally uproot, root out, and destroy that vain religious apostate element and do it once and for all out in that fifth course of punishment. That's when it's always actually going to take place. And you can actually see that occurring in Deuteronomy 29, 23 through 29, through the end of that chapter, that it's really a massive subject. And again, it has a lot to do with tracking, with something that I probably haven't taught very much here on, but it's understanding how God views the nation of Israel as a nation and what he's going to do with them and how he's going to deal with them. And there's certain things, and it comes as no surprise that when we come to Romans 9, 10, and 11, what does Paul say Israel's state is right now? They're what? They're cursed. Yeah, bad question. Sorry. Yeah, they're blinded partially. And they are. The nation of Israel is not going to ever respond to Jesus Christ as their Messiah in this dispensation of grace. They're blinded to it. That doesn't mean an individual Jew can't be one to Christ. I grant you, they're tough nuts to crack. And to be quite honest with you, it almost takes a Jew to lead another Jew to Christ in some cases. Some of them are so liberal they don't even understand what Judaism is. But you understand what I mean when I'm making the distinction between nationally and individually. And that verse does seem odd and out of place unless you understand and appreciate what God had already reckoned to do with that nation and how he's going to keep them in that position and see to it that they remain to where he can one day purge that element out. Sometimes God sees this part of the chart and that part of the chart that far apart. We see it as thousands and thousands of years, and sometimes there's a magnificent place in the book of Isaiah where the difference between the first course of punishment and the kingdom is a comma. It's that close together. So anyway, I hope that clarifies that issue. And beginning next time, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at more just a few of the details of the contract there in chapter 30, the first 10 verses. So what I would do between now and Wednesday night is read through again chapter 30 and familiarize yourself especially with those first 10 verses, and we'll take a look at some of the details of this additional covenant and how grand it is to see God in his Jehovahness and grace doing for them what they could not do for themselves. We didn't have time to do this today, but you should be able to go to Romans 9, 10, and 11. I would do this. I would in the course of our studies, I'd go back and refresh myself on those three chapters and just see with more perception how you can now make these connections that Paul makes when he talks about to Israel is given the adoption and the covenants and the promises and all of these kinds of things. And you've got some real connections to make because you've got some intelligence now and understanding what's going on. Well, we'll stop right there and we'll pick it up next time with our heads bowed. Heavenly Father.